Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
It was just a natural flow.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 151, a talk with Alaa B. Alaa B is a longtime member of the Nation of Gods and Earths, formerly known as the Five Percenters. Alaa B grew up in Harlem in the 1950s and 60s, a time when the Nation of Islam had huge influence thanks to its minister, Malcolm X. Clarence 13X Smith was an NOI member who became disenchanted with the group around 1963 and formed his own organization the following year. Clarence quickly became known as Alaa, or the Father, and most of his early disciples were teenage boys, Alaa B among them. The group grew steadily until Alaa's murder in June 1969. It would have a rebirth in the 1980s and 90s, as many of the young children raised in the group's beliefs would go into hip-hop and spread Five Percenter beliefs, slang, and practices far and wide. If you've ever listened to Rakim, Big Daddy Kane, or the Wu-Tang Clan, said peace or word, or stood in a b-boy stance, you owe a huge debt to the gods and earth, whether you realize it or not. Alaa B has been there for the group's entire history, and he shares it with us here. We sat down with Alaa B in the garden outside their Harlem headquarters, the Alaa School in Mecca. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should hear our interview with another key player in the Harlem of the 1960s and 70s, the last poets Abi Odun Oyewole, on episode 19. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making this show sustainable. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's a man who will really enlighten us with the knowledge of the cypher, Alaa B. So I guess I just want to get started by talking about some of the stuff we were just talking about off mic. What was your, you know, tell me a little bit about you and your early life before you met the father.
Well, before I met the father, I was born and raised in Harlem, uptown 146th Street, as is considered upper Manhattan. And I went to elementary school in Harlem, 147th Street, PS 90. I was one of the youth coming up at that time that would later be one of the pioneer youths in Harlem that Dr. Kenneth B. Clark wrote about in his thesis of the Harlem Youth. It's called The Dark Ghetto.
Kenneth B. Clark's book, Dark Ghetto, Dilemmas of Social Power, was originally published in 1965. The book describes how the ghetto separates blacks not only from white people, but also from opportunities and resources. He and his wife also founded the organization Harlem Youth Opportunities Unlimited, or HARU, which comes up later in this discussion.
And like most youth at that time, we were seeking knowledge of self, but not in that fashion that we wanted an identity of who we were in terms of Africa. We had learned that we was from Africa. 1954 was a big monumental time for us. As a youth, a baby, I guess I was about...
You were about 6 years old or so.
6 years old. Yeah. And education was important as they had the Brown versus the Board of Education, and it was a big Supreme Court case. So this was something that was national in regards to not only education, but blacks receiving an equal education in America. And I was included in that because I was only 6 years old, perhaps in the first grade. And it made a whole lot of press. So that, you know, was awakening for me in terms of my community, the education, and my community in the education and relationships to the world, that we was discriminated against educationally, but I didn't know what that meant at that particular time.
Well, it's all you knew.
Right. Yeah. But I knew that they was dealing with children and children's education. And Dr. Kenneth Clark, he was a psychologist who spoke about identity of the black child, that we was receiving inferior education. And he had an experiment that was very popular that he used in the court case, saying that 67% of the black children that he had in this study had preferred, when offered, which doll did they like.
They like the white doll.
White doll. And they chose, black children choosing the white doll indicated that they didn't have no real self-identity, that they had preferred the image of the major culture, which we was a minority in America, so our major culture in America was, you know, the white, Caucasian. And we chose that, and that was indicated to him as a psychologist, clinically, a lack of self identity and thus self-esteem. I didn't know all that as I'm kicking it with, but as a child, I heard that. And later, as I grew up in Harlem, I became one of the youth that was considered a delinquent, all right, a juvenile delinquent. And Bobby Kennedy, he was a senator of New York, I believe, at that time, and he did some research on the Harlem youth. And they started a program, the first anti-poverty program in America, How You Act.
How You Act was a unification of the aforementioned Harlem Youth Opportunities Unlimited organization and a project called Associated Community Teams, or ACT. The latter was a special priority of the powerful Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Its primary goal was to train people from Harlem and other urban communities to work within ACT's youth services programs.
Which was an act of Congress now, so even though I was a youth in Harlem going through my everyday whatever, it was some big people in America focusing on the attention of the youth, more specifically the Harlem youth.
Right. And so we're sitting, you know, obviously at the Al-Azhar School in Mecca, not far from the site of where Mosque Number 7 used to be.
Yes, we would say about 10 blocks from the original Mosque Number 7 was on 116th Street.
Right.
102, 116 between Lenox and 7th.
And you used to see Malcolm X there.
Yeah, I used to see Malcolm X when I was about 12, 13 years old. I used to go down there. I mean, Malcolm became known to me, I think, in 58, 59. I was about 10 or 11. And they had a big incident in Harlem about a Muslim being brutalized by the police.
Mm-hmm.
And Malcolm took a whole force of the FOI to the precinct and demanded that he be released from the precinct and taken to the hospital.
This April 1957 incident involving a member of Malcolm's mosque named Johnson X Hinton had, in addition to NOI members, up to 4,000 people surrounding the police precinct demanding Hinton's release. You can see this event dramatized in Spike Lee's Malcolm X biopic.
Right, very famous incident.
Famous incident. Yeah. So that, you know, glamored in Harlem, and as a youth, I had a great sense of identification with a black man standing up in, you know, this type of situation. So I wanted to meet him. And I knew my way to 116th, and I used to go there to the mosque on Sunday at 2 o'clock, and they had a ritual that if you wanted to shake the minister's hand, you had to join, you know? So, of course, I acted and imitated like I was going to join to shake his hand, and I used to do that every week. I never sent a letter in or anything of that nature because it wasn't my suit of clothes or being a youth, put on a bow tie and things of that nature. But I did like what Malcolm was saying, and I liked the way he stood up as a man, you know.
What did you get to see him speak? Like, what do you remember about
him speak, every Sunday at 2 o'clock, it was an open forum, so to speak. Everybody was invited to the mosque. And on one side, the men sat on one side. The FOI, the Fruit of Islam, sat up in the front with bow ties and their uniforms. And the women sat on the other side in their uniforms, covered three-fourths. And the visitors would generally sit in the back, male on one side, female on the other side. And the minister would be up in the front with his bodyguards, and he would be teaching, right? And it was enlightening, informative, and it was inspiring to, you know, have a someone that was black who, like myself, had came through the, you know, the murk of society, you know, the bottom rung of society, and he was in the street, and he hustled, and went to prison, and went through all the hell that, you know, at that time a black man was going through, because we was thinking that our rites of passage had to go through prison. And Malcolm went through those rites of passage and came out, went through that hell, so to speak, and came out right. He was no longer in the streets. He was a good example for his people as a stand-up man, and he was teaching, as he said, civilization to the savage, and we were savage eating the wrong foods.
The man then known as Clarence 13X, who would become Allah or the Father, was a member of the Nation at that time, but left in 63. As far as you know, why did he leave?
Well, as far as I know, as he told me, that he was what Malcolm had started a class called Student Minister Class, and they called it the Class of God. And he was one of the student ministers. He was called a high scientist in the Marxists. He was an advanced fruit.
When Allah B says fruit here, he is referring to the fruit of Islam, the paramilitary wing of the Nation of Islam. During this period, the FOI was led by the powerful Joseph Gravett, known as Captain Joseph. Joseph would later take the name Imam Yusuf Shah.
And a lieutenant in their ranks teaching karate to the FOI. And he also was a student minister, so he had the access to the lessons.
The lessons referred to here are the Nation of Islam's Supreme Wisdom Lessons, a series of transcribed dialogues between NOI founder Fard Muhammad and Elijah Muhammad. They were essential scripture for the NOI, and access was limited only to registered members. They eventually became a key part of the Gods and Earth's teachings in a slightly modified form and renamed the 120 Lessons.
And they would go through the practice of teaching like Malcolm did, from the roster, so to speak, to the other student ministers. And he was building on a degree we call the eighth degree, what makes rain, hell, snow, and earthquake. And he was coming real seriously on it, and he was interrupted and called into Captain Joseph's office.
After this was being the head of the Fruit of Islam.
He was the head of the Fruit Islam. He was the top security officer in the Mars, if not the whole nation at that time. And he told Allah that he couldn't teach what he was teaching in the Mars, and that he had to leave. And that's what Allah told me. And there was no violations cited as, you know, any rules or regulations. There was no hearing for him to be suspended, given a sentence, kicked out the Mars, for that matter. Right, but he just left, and he had to take his teaching. He was told he couldn't teach that there, and he had to take his teachings out, and that's what he did.
So the father left the Nation in 1963. The following year, he begins what was then called the Five Percenters.
The Nation of Gods and Earths originally called themselves Allah's Five Percenters, or the 5% Nation. This refers to the idea that 10% of the people in the world know the truth of existence, but opt to keep 85% of the world in ignorance and under control. The remaining 5% know the truth and want to enlighten the 85%. In the late 80s, the name gradually began to shift from the 5%ers to the Nation of Gods and Earths, although the exact point of change is hard to nail down. The change, which seemed to start around 1987, echoed two changes in the movement: that they were truly separate from the Nation of Islam, and that the original youths of the movement had become men or gods. The Nation of Gods and Earths has come to teach that black people are the original people of the planet, and men are the fathers or gods, and women are the mothers or earths of civilization.
A lot of who he was preaching to in the early days were kids who, like yourself, were teenagers. Why do you think his message resonated so much with the youth?
Well, I tell you, we always say that it resonated with the youth primarily because we was considered pure at heart, in that we hadn't been defiled, as we said, the older brothers and sisters. They was like at eight pig over a long period of time, right? And we hadn't. We was young, and more specifically, morally, that anything that we had done under 16 years young, we wasn't responsible, that we were minors, and our parents were generally responsible, and even in the court of law, We were youthful offenders if we made any offense. So we wasn't responsible, and everything that we may have done really didn't count against us in terms of moral rights and judgments and things of that nature. So we was more receptive, not only morally, but consciously, that our consciousness hasn't been saturated with the ways of the world.
And is it true that the first time you met the father, he helped you escape from the cops?
Not escape. I wouldn't put it in them terms. He enabled me to distance myself from being apprehended. Well, how you like that?
What's the story there?
Well, I was wayward. As I said, I was a juvenile delinquent, you know, classified and been through the system at that time. I was 16, 1964, and Thanksgiving was coming up. And I was very fashionable in my clothes, alligator shoes, lizards, silk, suede, leather, and all that. And a new style hat came out called the Fletcher. And it came from Britain, like the Beatles at that time. And it was a cashmere hat, and I had to have it. And I went and took it from a Knox hat store on 125th Street. And I ran down, after running out the store with the hat, down towards, running back uptown, going home past 126th Street. And the father was in a bar called the Wordwork Bar that used to be on the corner, and had a big plate glass window. And I didn't know it at the time, but he had a custom of being at the chicken counter in the bar, looking out of that window. And I guess it might have been for that very purpose, because he was taking care of the children. And I came running into his view, I guess, and he seen me, and he came out the bar just as I was crossing the street. But I had seen this silhouette in the plate glass window, but I didn't recognize who he was until he came out of the door. And I kept running. I didn't stop. And I got to about, I think it was a store about over here called Bob's, a grocery store. And I looked back. I ventured to look back. But I knew the police had his gun out because he said, "Halt, stop." And I seen the father stand in the same path that I had just crossed. And he was directing the officer to the street. And mind you, look, this is a downtown street going downtown, so the officer had to run against traffic. And he went out to that traffic, and he just gave up. I seen him F him, like, fuck him. Yeah. And I kept on running, turned this corner, 127th Street. But I had to thank the man for doing that, and because two of my friends had got killed in 1964. Kenny Ballinger got thrown off the roof by police, and Brother Powell, he got killed by Lieutenant Gallagher, shot down like a dog for no reason at all. And we rioted 6 days in July because of that.
The incident Alabi is talking about here came to be known as the Harlem Riot of 1964. A 15-year-old named James Powell was shot and killed by Lieutenant Thomas Gilligan in front of over a dozen witnesses. The rioting lasted from July 16th to July 22nd, 1964, and ended with one dead, 118 injured, and 465 arrested.
And I knew the threat that the police had represented to the youth in Harlem at that time because of those two murders, you know, and I could have been potentially the third wounded, arrested, right? And I did wrong, I admit that, but I thought about that. So I came back to thank him the next day to the spot where I seen him, right here at the Warwick Bar, which is right next to the school, but it was a barbershop at that time. But he wasn't on that corner. He was on the corner of 127th Street on the same avenue, 7th Avenue. And I went down there. I seen the crowd and went down there and stood in the crowd as he was building in the cipher. And I didn't call it building at that time, but he was in building in that cipher. And I just waited until I can get his attention to give him my thanks. And I silently mouthed, "Thank you." And he looked at me and winked and smiled, and I was real pleased with that. I was more pleased with what he was saying. And he was saying almost the same things that Malcolm was saying, but now he was giving me a suit of clothes to it that I could readily put on, that I didn't have to change my dress, because I was a young, if you will, a young fly guy dressing nice in the street, and I really loved that. And he was giving me that knowledge that I wanted, but it was with, you know, the suit of clothes for the youth. that I could be me with this knowledge.
Right. And as you got to know him, I know this is a big question, and we could probably spend the rest of the interview talking about this, but briefly, what was he like?
Well, a lot of people say he was like a father, and he was. But I really looked at him as a god. He was a god to me. And I told him this one time when he asked me what was the most important sentence of the first degree of the 1 to 40. You know, and that's a sentence that's serious. It has great significance. Who made the Holy Quran, the Bible? How long ago? Will you tell us why does Islam renew its history every 25,000 years?
In case you missed that, due to Alabi's practice rapid-fire delivery, he is reciting the first question of what is referred to as the 1 to 40, a series of 40 questions and answers that is part of the 120 lessons. The question is, who made the Holy Quran or Bible? How long ago? Will you tell us why does Islam renew her history every 25,000 years?
And I told him that the most important sentence to that, to me, was, you know, you all are, as I said, you all are, black man coming from the east to the west to deliver his lost seed in his last days. But he told me, no, that wasn't the most important. The most important was that the Nation of Islam is all wise and does everything right and exact. And that was like mind-blowing, but it was the most simplest thing there, that if you do everything right and exact, then you're going to be perfect. And mathematics is a precise language of perfection, that there is no recorded history of mathematics ever making a mistake. And that was profound to me, that I sought out the error, not in his ways, but in his teaching. And I couldn't find no errors in his teaching. And I found that he was perfect, not only in his application of mathematics, but in expressing the life, because he also taught me that Allah spelt out on his body. You know, and it was simple, that if I ever examined myself, arm, leg, leg, arm, head. And that was his name. So when I chose my name the first time, Born Allah, that's what I chose. I was born Allah. I mean, I was born, and when I looked at my body, it spelled out the name Allah. So I was born Allah. And he gave me that perfection. And that's how I looked at it, and that's how I seen it. And that, you know, he was precise in his application of mathematics. And I understood why, of all the men that came with this knowledge at the time that he did, that he was the one. And then I looked at his name, Clarence, and that simply means clear seeing, a clear being. So, I mean, it was all in him, all about him. And that's how, and he had a smile that was a killer smile, you know, and that was his pure disposition. And then he really said that he came to get the ones that nobody else wanted, and that was the babies. Like, I never forget that Dr. Kenneth Clark, along with Robert Kennedy and the whole United States government, United States Congress, was looking at investigating the youth at that time. And we didn't know it, but they was determining what to do with us, as Hoover later said that they targeted Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, the father with the FBI files and everything. But in his COINTELPRO platform and strategy is that they really was concentrating on the young recruits. And the whole thing was geared at the young recruits. And I never forget how they killed the FBI and the Chicago Police Department and all their agencies killed Fred Hampton, a chairman of the Black Panther Party, while he was in bed,
sleeping.
While he was in bed, drugged by their agent, and his pregnant wife was in the bed.
Well, this sounds like the stuff of a bad X-Files episode. The account Alabi here gives is entirely accurate. Hampton and fellow Panther Mark Clark were killed by a police raid on December 4th, 1969, after Hampton was slipped a powerful sleep agent by FBI informant William O'Neill. The raid was jointly coordinated by the Cook County State Attorney's Office, the Chicago PD, and the FBI.
You know, and I just communicated with Fred Hampton Jr. too. He was in Harlem on the 26th. And I never forget that, but I didn't see all of that at that time. I'm seeing that in retrospect, hindsight, as I'm speaking to you. But I know that we was targeted like that because the police came to my high school and I hadn't done anything, and they was asking me about the 5%ers. They wanted to know about my affiliation with me, with myself. So I knew we was targeted, but we was targeted by United States Congress with the Harlem Youth Act,
right,
of the 89th Congress.
Right. The head of that, Livingstone, he was no friend to you guys.
While he was the director of the Haru Act, Wingate would frequently make alarmist statements about upcoming youth uprisings, often to deflect accusations about his own financial mismanagement. Dr. Kenneth Clark himself accused Wingate of black McCarthyism and called his statements about the youth and 5%ers in particular fantastic, dangerous, and irresponsible.
He was a tool, and he was a tool in that he would come to us like a trader, you know, trading goods.
Mm-hmm.
And the goods that he was trading was programs. Right? The father wanted an educational program, a street academy for high school dropouts so that we can get back in the educational system to go get the skills and trades and profession that we need at a high level. So we was high school dropouts. We had to drop back in to school, and the father hooked up with Dr. Edward Coppinger, who later became God Cop, and he was the headmaster of Harlem Prep.
Right.
Right? So the father geared us towards that area with those people, and Livingston Wingate was one of those stepping stones that was used by the government to be in place to give us the tools that we needed.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't no real friend of ours.
Right, because he was also raising alarms about you guys.
Yes, he was.
The press.
He was the initial one that, I believe, claimed that we was going to ride if we didn't get the Haru Act funds
right.
from Congress, the continuing Haru Act funds. Dr. Kenneth Clark, he was more, you know, concerned with the youth, I believe, because he opened up the first Afro House. And at that time, we was being introduced to a drummer from Africa, Alatunji.
Babatunde Olatunji was a Nigerian drummer, educator, social activist, and recording artist. His 1959 debut album, Drums of Passion, introduced many Americans to world music. He worked with Cannonball Adderley, Max Roach, Stevie Wonder, Quincy Jones, Horace Silver, and countless others, and passed away in 2003.
And Dr. Kenneth Clark set those things up without major funds from the government. But he later got major funds from the government because he was the first director of the Haru program.
And one thing about the father that he liked to do and that has continued in his disciples was break down words.
Yeah, he broke down the words. And what I loved about it, and it taught me an awful lot, not only did he give us the supreme mathematics and the supreme alphabets, therefore, you know, in the beginning was the word, all about the word was Allah, God. And the word was important. Have you not heard that your word should be born regardless of whom or what? Yes, emphatically, right? And we come from that perspective. The word is all important because you ain't got nothing if you don't have your word. But the father used to break the word down in syllables. And one of the best words for me that he broke down was not civilization, but was helicopter. And
how would he break that down?
He would break it down just like I just broke it down. Helicopter, right? Hell, the lie, copped her. And what that meant was that the lie of hell copped our black woman. Because we say that Yakub made the devil through the sex of man and woman, and he used the lie to the woman. So the hell copped her, all right? And that put us in the light that we know that our woman going to be tricked before the man going to be tricked, because the man going to be the warrior and the protector of the nation. But the woman, if she's separated from the man, she's going to have that tendency to be submissive towards someone that she sees as a dominant. Okay, and in that relationship, man and woman, the man is the dominant, the woman is not weak, but not recessively weak, excuse me, but is weak to the extent of her physicality, that on moments, she gonna have to have someone to lean on. Of course, the man gonna have to have moments to lean on someone too, so he lean on his woman in the moments that he need, but he would be in the survival mode more than the woman. And that psychology still plays out today.
All that came from just breaking down the word.
Yeah, the word. And because, like, now, when you go into the etymology of the word, hello means sun, right? And cop, right, is a protector. And in Arabic, cop means the sharif. And it gives you a whole history of what the sharif is. And the sharif is like the sun, the ruler of the universe that sets forth the law and order. As a cop is law and order, the sharif in Arabic or Islam is the sheriff of law and order. So it gave me, in that one word, the etymology or the origin of the word of not only the West, but the East as well, right? And the terror, it, you know, like terror, the prefix of the word earth, terror, terror, right? And we call our women the earth, terror, her, right? So that put me into the terrestrial aspect of the word. And I went there and looked at it terrestrially, right? And anytime you look at something terrestrially, you have to have a corresponding factor, and that's the celestial. So it took me back to the universe, which is the first part of hello. Hello, that's the sun. Like the Helotropics, the right. Greek city of Helotropics, and so forth and so forth. So with one word, and I was in the class when we had the class here, and the father stopped and just broke that one word down. And, like, I mean, it just, like, boom. And I ain't even talking about breaking it down just by according to the supreme alphabet.
The alphabet, yeah. You know? Which actually brings up another thing. You know, you've mentioned supreme alphabet, supreme mathematics a couple times. These were things that the father and a few other people, brother Jimmy Abu Shahid, a few other people developed.
John Brooks, later known as John 37X and then Abu Shahid, met the father when they were both in the Nation of Islam. They quickly became extremely close friends and, according to Shahid, developed together a system called Living Mathematics that assigned different qualities to the numbers 1 through 12, which would, with minor changes, become supreme mathematics. James, brother Jimmy Howard, also known as Justice, became the father's new partner after Abu Shahid was arrested and did 6 months in jail for gun possession. Jimmy was, in some tellings, responsible for turning living mathematics into supreme mathematics and helping to develop the supreme alphabet, which assigned different qualities to each letter of the alphabet.
Can you explain to people who might not know what...
Okay, I would like to straighten that out.
Sure.
The father developed them himself. People attribute Shahid, the father's brown seed, Justice, the father's right-hand man, to helping him with that. Mm-hmm. They didn't help him with that. Shahid tells many people that he helped with that, but he didn't. Shahid met the father as Allah in Queens, as they were selling newspapers in Queens. And the father was telling a Muslim brother that he was Allah, and he was manifesting it to that Muslim brother. And Shahid, being John, his honorable name, John 37X, was a witness to that. He John'd it. And he became enlightened by the father, and then he became the father's brown seed from there. But the father already had his program together when he manifested it to John, although he may say something different. Then other people would attribute Justice, they call Jimmy Jam, to helping him. He was his helper, you know, and Allah and Justice was dynamite working together. But the father had his program together when he introduced them to his teachings.
Okay, so yes. Now that, you know, now that's been straightened out, like, for people who might not know, what are the supreme alphabet, the supreme mathematics?
Well, the supreme mathematics is the key to understanding the universe and everything, and life, love, peace, and happiness.
One is knowledge. Two is wisdom. Three is understanding. The devil's underhanded. Four is culture, freedom. Five is power, refinement. Six is equality. Newborns follow me. Seven is God. Eight is build or destroy. Nine is born. You forget to rewind the song. Zero is cipher. Now there you have it. Cause I sincerely love Allah's mathematics. Supreme mathematics. The same black magic. I do my work amongst dope fiends and crack addicts. Civilize the savage.
It is based upon principles of knowledge, which is always the first thing that one has to do. So we attribute the first character of mathematics as being knowledge. That's the first characteristic that we had to do. So number one, off the top, first things first is knowledge. That if you know something, then you could do it correctly. If you don't know something, then you can't do nothing with nothing. So you got to have some knowledge.
So you have the number foundation. Number one is equivalent to knowledge.
Two is the way, wisdom, that you could do things as a wise person or you could do it as ignorant and dumb. If you don't have no knowledge, then you're going to be ignorant. And an ignorant person is a dumb person. They're illiterate because they don't know. They unlearned or either unread, whatever the case may be. So in order to do things correctly, right, you have to have knowledge, which is one. And then you have to know the way to go about that knowledge, which is two. Not to fall off the edge. You be wise and not dumb, right? And that be the dome of your own kingdom, to do everything right and exact. And then you have to have something to stand on. You know, your knowledge is your foundation, so the knowledge of your own understanding, your knowledge has a standing of which is under your knowledge. And that's where we get our understanding.
Understanding, which is equivalent
exactly.
to three. Exactly.
Yeah. And that's the way of your expression. The way of your expression is the fourth one. That's culture. And in your culture is really the way that you do things, your manifestation, how you express it. In your arts, your science, your literature, whatever the case may be, that's particular to you, and that's always your power. And that's the fifth element of our principles of mathematics, power. You know, and our power is a power of attraction, magnetic. Not only do we, you know, exude it, gives it off, but we give it off to attract others into it to show them the benefit of having this righteous power from the perspective of our, you know, self being one and the same. And we're not afraid to deal equal. That's equality. That's our sixth principle of mathematics, that we deal in equality. Equality means to be equal in everything, and that means to be the same. So we're not going to be hoarding this knowledge that we know is from God. And godliness is, you know, the key to everything. That's the seventh figure. And we say the seven heavens, the seven levels, the seven planes, the seven everything in the universe, you know, that we build towards, and that's the eighth. And we build positively to destroy all negativity. And we're not talking about, you know, the negative in, like we like to express mathematically, in algebra, when you multiply, you know, add on two multiples, the negative negative in the multiplication of algebra, which is the great reducer of fire, you create a positive. You know, so in that instance, that's a bill. The negativity is what is descend, and when it's in the descending order of things, that's the negativity that we destroy, that distills and takes away from, right? And we born alive, which is our ninth element, into life itself, and we are born alive, not stillborn. So whatever we build upon, we make it born, make that knowledge born, so that knowledge could add on the cipher. And when that knowledge add on the cipher, you got a completion, because the cipher is what we call 360 degrees of a manifestation of a thing,
yeah.
A person, place, a thing, idea. So we bringing it into existence. We bring the idea into existence with a determination, so it go according to the mathematics. And when it go according to the mathematics, it go according to that is right and exact, and not in wrong and in error. And that is right and exact. It's all good for everybody, all the human families of the planet Earth, as we teach.
Great. And, you know, so similarly to the way Supreme Mathematics attributes a different element to every number, the Supreme Alphabet attributes a different element to every letter of the alphabet. Now, one of the things the father did that was very controversial was he took the, what was called at the time, or still is called, the 120 lessons, which was something the Nation of Islam used, right? A dialogue between Elijah Muhammad and Fard Muhammad, and started spreading it out, teaching it to people like you, teaching it to teenagers. Why was that not done before he did it?
Well, when Master Farad Muhammad came in 1930 and taught in Detroit, he had called the lessons the secret teachings of the Nation of Islam. and they was in Stroud in secret, that up until that time they hadn't been revealed to no black man in America, especially, as it was called, the so-called American Negro. So when it was revealed to Elijah Muhammad and the other blacks in Detroit, it was built as secrets being revealed, and that they didn't want, as they was calling, the profane or the savage to get it, because they wouldn't know how to control the flow of it. That truth in the unlearned hands can be very destructive, as they said. And in certain instances, that may be true. If you don't know how to use a thing, if you get a tool and don't know how to use it properly, you can destroy yourself or someone else. So that was their view. And they had a way of disseminating that information from the secret teachings of the Nation of Islam through the minister in the mosque. Mm-hmm. So they had to build temples and disseminate that, and you had to get it in the temple. And if you didn't get it in the temple, then you was getting it in a profane way. And it wasn't the way that they said, according to their civilizing factor of platforms, that you're supposed to get it. But the father didn't recognize it as such. He recognized that this was knowledge, and knowledge was free to the world, and that he didn't have no restraints on it, and he wouldn't let no one put no restraints on that knowledge, because it was his knowledge. Right. And he could do as he pleased with that knowledge. And it was free, and he gave it to anybody that was receptive to it. First, he manifested in the Mars, and he questioned them on how to build on the eighth degree, but he questioned them on the first degree. Who is the original man? And that went straight to the heart of the way Master Farad came.
That was one of his big differences.
That was a great difference.
Yeah.
Because
can you explain that for people who wouldn't know?
The difference was that the first degree manifests who is the written man. It answers as Master Farad gave this information to Elijah Muhammad, one of the lost found in the wilderness of North America around 1934, but he was giving it to him from 30 on. And he asked, who is the written man? And answer, the original man is the Asiatic black man, the maker, the owner, the cream of the planet Earth, father of civilization, and God of the universe. And he emphasized the original Asiatic black man. Okay, so if asked who is the original, you want the Pacific answer, and it was the original. And Farad was not the original man. He was a black man, but he was not the original. His father was a black man, and his mother was a white Caucasian woman,
right,
out of Turkey, right? And he didn't make no racial distinctions of his mother, but he made the distinctions of his biological makeup. And his biological makeup was that he was not the original Asiatic black man. And he was emphasized, the father emphasized, that the original man is the Asiatic black man. And that Asiatic black man didn't have Turkey in part of his makeup. Okay, and he distinguished that.
Asiatic in this context refers to the Nation of Islam's belief, adopted by the gods and earth, that in the beginning of human history, the entire planet was named Asia. Therefore, all black and indigenous people are of Asiatic origin. What he's saying here is this. The founder of the NOI, Fard Muhammad, claimed in the Supreme Wisdom Lessons that the original man is the Asiatic black man. So Allah said, basically, Fard founded this organization, but why is he the supreme leader when he's not the original man? Because his mom was white. So essentially, why are we following this guy?
And that was heretic to, I guess, the ministers and the captains of Temple Number 7 at that time. So they told me he couldn't teach that. So he came where he could teach it, and he gave it to us, and we understood exactly what he was teaching, because he wasn't anti-white when he taught it, and nor was he pro-black when he taught it. He was for righteousness, and being for righteousness, he had to do everything right and exact according to them supreme mathematics.
Makes sense. And, you know, Allah was murdered in June of 1969. What do you remember about? Do you remember that day? What do you remember about that day?
Yeah, I remember that day. I was supposed to be getting up at 6 in the morning, but I had a difficult time. In fact, the last time I saw him was June 11th. Right out here at the school. And he had admonished me to stay in the Bronx and teach the babies. That's where he wanted me. He didn't want me down here with him. You know, my days with him was over, so to speak, as he was telling me since 1968, what you going to do when I go? You know, that he was going
He was talking about his own passing the year before his death.
His equality was born, so to speak. And if his equality was born, he had to leave so that I could show and prove that I was God. He taught me that I was God, and I had to show and prove that. It just couldn't be a word-of-mouth thing. It had to be something to prove it. And he said that if he was still here, I wouldn't be able to prove that because I would be dependent on him. So he had to go. And we always used to look at that the king must die in order for the son to become the king. So he was the king in my estimate, and I was this prince. And in order for the prince to become the king had to go, transpire. But I didn't look at it then like that, but I knew that's what he was talking about. You know, in order for his equality to be born, it had to manifest it like he did. And he couldn't be here for us to manifest it. We'd be too be dependent.
He had, at that point, a whole lot of enemies. Even a lot of, you know, obviously, as we talked about the first time we met, both the FBI and the bossy section, the Bureau of Special Services of the NYPD, were surveilling him. A lot of black militants didn't like him because of some of his political ideas. Obviously, the Nation of Islam didn't like him. So a lot of enemies on all sides. Do you have any idea what may have happened with
his
murder?
Not specifically. I mean, but I always look at it from this end. Who had the most to gain with him not being here, with his demise? I mean, who thought that he was the enemy? You know, he didn't have no enemies by virtue of him doing anything wrong to anybody personally. Right? So it was a matter of his teachings. Like, I never forget the night that he told me that to be careful in the Bronx, that he had just came back from a party at Mayor Lindsay's office. And Barry Gotter was like the host, right? And he was in the crowd, as Barry related. The father didn't tell me who he was in the crowd with, but it was directors of movies, Hollywood directors, chief of police, chief of the firemen.
Is this the famous cops and robbers party that Barry threw?
As they relate. But he told me it was a Christmas party.
Barry Gotter was an aide to NYC Mayor John Lindsay. He organized the Urban Action Task Forces, neighborhood-based groups created to anticipate local grievances and to quell unrest. He was particularly fond of Allah and provided the five percenters with bus rides to the beach and picnics, airplane rides, and other amenities, as well as helping them to get their building in Harlem, the very location where this interview is taking place. The 1967 Cops and Robbers Party was intended as a surreal sort of social experiment. He hoped to bring together characters from all walks of New York life. Movie stars, revolutionaries, businessmen, politicians, clergymen, police, union leaders, and see how they'd interact for an evening. For the role of revolutionary, Gotter invited Allah.
He told me that to be careful in the Bronx, because I was teaching in the Bronx, and the Bronx district attorney had threatened him that if he brought his teachings to the Bronx, although it was all right for him to teach in New York County, Brooklyn County, Queens County, but if he brought his teachings to Bronx County, he would have his black ass put in jail just for teaching. So he had enemies, if you will, for his teachings. Not for something that he did against the law, assault, battery, robbing somebody, or doing something to somebody personally. And I always thought that was, like, damn serious, that you talk about freedom of expression, here it is, a government official is telling him that he going to put his black ass in jail if he brought his teachings to the Bronx. And the father told me that night. And in 76, Barry Gotter wrote it in a book, copyright book.
Yeah.
Right. So it was confirmed by another, you know, and this was, you know, the hike of racism that, you know, Muhammad Ali fought as a conscientious objector of not going into the army to fight the Vietnamese, who never called him nigger. For the United States government. you know, and here is a member of the United States government, a government official, district attorney, and he was the super district attorney of New York at that time, Burton Roberts, is persecuting a law because of his teachings. So I knew I was going to be persecuted because of my teachings, because I was later prosecuted by Burton Roberts as well.
Right, absolutely. One final thing about those days in New York, and then I want to ask you about some stuff of how his teachings manifested later on.
Yes.
One of the big things that the father got credit for, you know, nationally, was helping to prevent riots in New York City after Martin Luther King was killed. Mm-hmm. Were you around that night?
Yes, I was.
What happened?
Well, I wasn't around when the thing took place with the riot and the stopping of the riot. Mm-hmm.
Right after Martin Luther King's assassination on April 4th, 1968, Barry Gotther was told by Mayor John Lindsay of growing mobs in Harlem. He immediately went uptown, found Allah, and told him that Lindsay himself would soon be in the neighborhood. According to Michael Muhammad Knight, quote, Allah left to round up his 5%ers and give them instructions, prevent fights, protect the stores, and spread word that Martin Luther King stood for peace and wouldn't want anyone honoring his memory through violence and destruction. The 5%ers acted as a makeshift security team for Mayor Lindsay in his walk through Harlem, though they ended up getting into a scuffle with a crew of men led by Joe Overton, head of the Harlem Retail Clerks Union, that caused the mayor to evacuate. Overton, according to Gotther, seemed, quote, more interested in exploiting the mayor than in helping us. After all was said and done, New York suffered only minimal damage as riots destroyed other urban areas across the country. You can see Mayor Lindsay's walk through Harlem, with Allah and Gotther's key parts unsurprisingly removed, dramatized on the show Mad Men.
I came about 12 o'clock that night, and the father was on the corner right here at 126th Street. And as soon as I walked up, he asked me, where you been? I say, and before I could explain, he said, oh, never mind. They got God, his name was Kasim at the time, his name God Supreme now. But they got Kasim in the precinct for assault on the police. Go down there and get him. And I said, okay. And I'd already had a relationship with the precinct captains and the deputy inspector of New York, the first black deputy inspector, Eldred Witt, and the governor's emissary. They were the governor's emissary when the father was in Manawa, and they had came to me. But anyway, he told me to go get him, so I went down there with four of the brothers. And before I left, he told me that Barry already cleared it. All you got to do is go down there and get him. And I went down there and got him. But later when I came back the next day, the father told me what had happened, that he had cleared the street because he didn't want a repeat of the 1964 riot when they killed Power, right? And we went crazy.
Right.
But that riot, we had devastated everything in our own community. And the father said that he had to go downtown to get milk for the babies. He had children. And because we were so foolish that we destroyed everything and we didn't have no supplies to take care of our own. So we couldn't wage a protracted war without producing for ourselves and being capable of treating our wounded. So forget that. And he wasn't going to let that happen again. So he stopped it before it got crazy. And when he did, a whole new technical force came up here after he quelled the riot, but seeing only the guards in the street, the 5%ers, Allah and the 5%ers in the street. But we was somewhat patrolling because the mayor had came and he let everybody know, but we were still like calming things after the mayor left. But this new unit came and they didn't know what was going on, and if they did, they didn't care. And they approached the father, and the father was explaining to them what the deal was. And out of nowhere, well, he told me someone said something in the back, and he had to turn around to tell him to be quiet. And when he did, a pig, and that's what he was, assaulted him. And when that happened, the guards just went berserk, you know, and it was a melee between Allah and the 5%ers and the police. Right? After we done did day work.
After you stopped.
After we did day work. And been commended by the mayor and all of that.
Yeah.
Right. And in that Mealy, they snatched the young brother Kasim. And when they snatched Kasim, that's when I came later that night at 12, and the father sent me down there to get him out. And it was a first for us because we hadn't known nobody that ever got out of jail for assault on the police. Okay, and that showed to me, you know, we had a little power. And they respected it, reluctantly, however, but they respected it nevertheless.
And so as one of what's sometimes called Pilon's firstborn...
Pilon, in God's and Earth's terminology, refers to the Bronx. When 5%er teachings are brought to a new city, the area is said to be reclaimed from the devil and is given a new name. Allah himself gave Harlem the name Mecca. Brooklyn became Medina, Queens the Desert, Staten Island, Savior's Island, and Allah renamed the Bronx Pilon, which was another name for Patmos, the island where Yaqub created the devil. Firstborn, in the group's terminology, refers to the first people to receive teaching. Hence, Pilon's firstborn means the first people to receive the group's teachings in the Bronx.
Some of the, is that an accurate title?
That's not accurate. They attribute me as being the firstborn, but okay. I was from Mecca, and I was one of the first to go up to Pilon to teach.
Right.
So the ones that I taught in Pilon, they were the firstborn of Pilon.
Okay. So
I was perhaps maybe one of the first teachers of the firstborn in Pilon.
Gotcha. So Pilon is the Bronx.
Yes.
And so you were in the Bronx in the late 60s up to maybe 71 or so.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that is a time that was when what would later become hip-hop was sort of bubbling.
Yes.
What were the connections you saw between that kind of culture of DJing and street parties and stuff and the gods?
Well, I think it was a serious, direct relationship, but it wasn't recognized as anything special or different. It was just that we was rapping in that we had the flow with the wisdom in our teachings, that the way we taught, when we spoke the lessons, we talked real rapidly.
I was going to ask about that. Do you see a connection between, it was sometimes in books, it's been called rapping, the way you guys would,
yes,
would talk about your lessons, you know, in the street. Do you see a connection between that and what would later be thought of as rapping?
It was a definite connection because it was attracting a lot of people, a lot of the youths. So if you wanted to rap, meaning teach or speak well, you get the knowledge. And a lot of people came and got the knowledge so that they could have the ability to rap and talk well. And like I had mentioned before, that we used to rap in certain instances, that is, not only to teach, but also to get the girls. And rap was a way to get the girls. And one of our popular men at that time, name was Rap, H. Rat Brown, and he was very popular, and he was the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a national organization, and the feds passed a law about him rapping.
H. Rat Brown, later known as Jamil Abdullah Alamin, was chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, in the 1960s, and briefly the Black Panther Party's Minister of Justice. He also wrote a powerful political autobiography in 1969. He is currently serving a life sentence for a murder following a 2000 shooting. The law Allah B mentions here is an anti-riot provision inserted into the Civil Rights Act of 1968. It is indeed sometimes known as the Rap Brown Law.
And it wasn't in the terms of music, but rapping with inflammatory rhetoric, as they call it, to inflame and incite others to riot. And they passed a law because he crossed one state line to go to another state and speak on college campuses, mind you, and next thing you know, it'd be a riot. So they say, no, we can't let him cross the state line to cause riots with his rap, and his nickname was Rap. So the emphasis of that for me was that rap was popular, not only in the person, Black Revolutionary, but in the very art form of our way of teaching, that when we taught, we rapped. We didn't just teach and speak plainly and all that. We taught and rap, sing songs sort of with a cadence.
Can you give me just for maybe like a few seconds an example of what that might have sounded like?
Well, I'll give it to you in a lesson. Like I always say, and that's the first lesson. Who's the written man? The written man is the aged Black man, maker of the own cream planetary father civilization, God of the universe. Okay? And some people's ears, they can't even understand what I'm saying, and I'm not saying it not to be understood. I'm saying it as a command of my words. But I'm saying it as it is a set form of words that I'm speaking, but I'm speaking it rapidly.
Yeah.
Okay?
And that exact lesson, actually, Grand Poobah would put in a song decades later.
I guess I'm like the verbalizer, fold the back of moving backwards. This Asiatic black man is a dog spelled backwards. The maker, the owner, the cream of the planet Earth, father civilization, god of the universe. Manifesting thought.
Yeah, in the 80s, I believe it was. Or 90.
1990, yeah. 90,
yeah.
So you have God's doing what is essentially kind of a proto-rapping.
Yes.
And starting to do that in the Bronx. And then you told me the first time we met that the neighborhood Kool Herc was from, he got his start right as the Gods were kind of having an influence there.
Yes. Well, we was always teaching, right, in Bronx River. Bronx River was one of the new areas that I was going in 71, Bronx River and Soundview, right? And we used to be out in the parks teaching and sitting on the benches, if you will. And Kool Herc came with music, you know? And the music was dynamite, popular. And it was always our thing. But some people didn't like the loud music, you know, because the speakers wasn't as popular at that time. And we did, and we appreciated it. And the people that tried to stop, neighborhood youths that tried to stop Kool Herc from playing his music on his turntables, the guards used to hold him down. And he'd tell everybody that when he first started, the guards used to hold him down because we appreciated the beats. The hip-hop culture didn't spring automatically like that, so we didn't even recognize it as hip-hop.
Sure.
You know, but for us, we was already rapping, and Kool Herc came with the beats, and it went together, in our estimate. But it didn't go together like this was going to be a new music genre, that this was going to be a new thing on the set. It was just a natural flow, you know, and that was enjoyment in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and you told me another thing you mentioned was that Russell Simmons had a very early run-in with the Gods back in his Queens days.
Yeah, the date that I remember, and Russell, he always tell a lot of people about, you know, the influence of the Gods building on the street corners and things of that nature.
Right, he mentioned that in his books and stuff.
Yes, he always write that. But I remember when I first met him, and it was casual, but it was real intense, that we had gave a dance, one of the first that we gave in Queens, in Hollis, Queens, where he's from, at the Aphrodisiac. And I'm sure he'll remember this, because it was an unforgettable event. And what it was that my brother Prince Allah, he helped start the Show and Prove. That's our annual event that we gave every year for the last 45 years. And it's upcoming June 12th of this year. Me and him gave a prelude to that at a dance at the Aphrodisiac. It was an old, I think, Safeway, turned into a community center. And we gave a dance there, party, live band and everything. And the neighborhood youth didn't know that a lot of people, namely the Gods and Earths, we as five percent, coming out of the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
transported and transplant in Queens. And they was used to having a party on the weekends from the locals, and they probably used to bum rush the door. So this night they came and bum rushed the door, but now you had the guards there and ain't nobody bum rushing our spot that we, you know, using it for that night. And they got a realization that, damn, there's some different people here. So when it came to my attention and I came outside, most of the guys ran, but a few of them was apprehended, if you will, or trapped by some of the younger guards. And Russell was one of them. And Prince had told me no, because they was getting ready to hurt him seriously. No, he's down with the coat check, because he used to work at this spot, and he used to do the coat check. So he claimed he was coming to do the coat check, and he was bringing his boys. And you ever see him bring this up? He was bringing his boys.
Yeah.
So we let him stay, do his coat check, and we became familiar, you know, friends with each other from that night.
Mm.
All right? He might have got a little inkling of later of who he really was, but that was my experience. And it was only one time that we even gave that dance in Hollis Green. I think it was 207, 207th Street.
What year was that, more or less?
That was in 70. That was December 4th, 1970. Mm-hmm.
Amazing. And, yeah, you know, as rap, as hip-hop developed, so much of its vocabulary came from you guys.
Well, we had a great influence because, again, I told you that the way we used to rap, they're in them words. So, like, one of our lessons, have you not heard that your word is bond? When we say word, that came from word is bond. Then it went into word, what up, word up. You know, that's the same as word bond. He dropped the bomb. We used to use it. He dropped the bomb.
Yeah.
He dropped the bomb on him.
What was the context you would use drop the bomb?
We was drop a lesson on him, and that was a bomb. You know, and it used to, people's brain cells, that we say, would explode with ideas. And that's what we used to do with our words. They had vibrations, and we would germinate an idea in somebody's head. So that was dropping a bomb on them.
And peace, obviously, was a
peace,
how
was
you
the
greet.
Key. That's
still
how we
greet each other.
That's how we greet, peace. And, like, that came, peace, peace out, you know. And I guess some people say peace in. The hippies used to say peace in or something like that.
And and God, obviously.
Yeah, God, well, that was an affiliation to the men of our nation.
Right.
You know, like, peace, God. What's up with that God? You know, that came from the gods, you know. Yeah.
And that, in some tellings, got shortened to G, which, well, some people now affiliate with gangster,
with gangster
or whatever.
Yeah. Well, they do. Like, they used to say the older gods, you know, the OGs. And then it went to old gangster and things of that nature. Well, you know, things get corrupt and distorted.
Sure. How did you feel when this slang, because I certainly remember it as a kid in the suburbs, you know, an hour and a half from here or whatever. How did you feel when you saw essentially your words going out into the wider world, often to people who had no idea where they were coming from?
Well, I felt elated. I felt good and great about it because it was all about teaching and influencing others with those teachings. So we, you know, needed the medium. You know, we did the work on the streets, word of mouth, you know, and we did it in the auditorium when we had parliaments, spreading the word. And we did it in the papers when we wrote the papers, the word, the Fiber Center, the Son of Man, those papers. So we was disseminating this, and now we had a broader medium in which to do it in, and that was the music.
Right.
And with the music, you got the, I think it was the vinyl first, then the cassettes, the 8-tracks, the discs, and then the videos and all of them things. So every level that, you know, it was just a progression of, you know, extending our teachings. And it just felt good that the word was getting out. That's what was important, and it felt good.
And, you know, by 1988 or so, you had some of the most popular rappers on the planet affiliated with the Gods and Earths. What was that like to have people like Kane and Rakim, you know, be giant stars and you know, going so far as, like, Rakim to wear the Universal flag on an album cover?
Yeah.
I came to overcome before I'm gone by showing and proving and letting ours be born. Then after that, I'll live forever. You disagree, you say never, then follow me from century to century. You remember me in history, not a mystery or a memory. Called by nature, mind raised in Asia. Since you was tricked, I have to raise you from the cradle to the grave. But remember, you're not a slave.
The Universal flag is the symbol of the Gods and Earths. It was created by Universal Sham God Allah and adopted in May 1966. Rakim wore a Dapper Dan designed jacket with a Universal flag on the back on the cover of the 1988 Eric B. and Rakim album, Follow the Leader.
Well, that was beautiful because about that time to put the Universal flag out there, that let everybody know that this was our symbol. And now our symbol became popular because people didn't know what it really meant or what it represented. And to get it out there with meaning and give them the true meaning of it, they begin to appreciate it more by virtue of, you know, seeing the sun, moon, and stars represented on our 8-point flag that we was not only building, but we building for the family. The sun, moon, and stars represented actually the black sun, moon, and stars, the black man, woman, and child. right? And you talk about man, woman, and child. You talk about all the human families that have a man, woman, and child in their family, the nuclear family. So that was powerful for us.
Yeah, and I couldn't let the opportunity to speak to you go by without talking about Brand Nubian, who obviously, you know, starting with their debut in 1990, were often taking a lot of their lyrics directly from the 120. How aware were you at the time that was going on?
Well, I was...
You were away.
I was in prison.
Yeah.
Alaa B was arrested in late 1971 for murder, convicted, and was in prison for almost 3 decades. Many 5%ers at the time described him as a political prisoner, actually arrested for passing on Alaa's teachings to the youth. While in jail, Alaa B got 2 college degrees, completed a number of different training programs, and won awards for his writing.
I was in constant contact with the nation because I had that constant contact with brothers that was and sisters that was coming to see me. One time I had as many as 50 people get on the bus to come and see me at one event in 1980. And one of the first papers, The Word, I was instrumental in helping publish The Word from where I was. I was instrumental in giving information about the adverse possession of retaining the school while I was in prison. So I was really involved with what was happening. So when it was told that, you know, they was going to do a video at the school. The attribute hides the helper to another God in need. He Allah God in Islam as I proceed to civilize the uncivilized. Word of wisdom to the groove from the wise. I guess I'm like the verbalizer for the fact of moving blackwards. This Asiatic black man is a dog spelled backwards. The maker, the owner, the cream of the planet Earth, father civilization, God of the universe. Brand Nubian's video for Wake Up was shot at the Alaa School in Mecca. We didn't have cable at that time in prison. So I was trying to find a spot in prison where I could see this video of what's that?
It was Yo MTV Raps. They shot both a video here and did a segment at the school.
Right. Yeah.
Welcome to Yo MTV Raps. The brothers that walk along with me today are down with the 5% Nation. And the main topic, of course, today is going to be brothers from the group, Brand Nubian. Want to say peace to y'all? All right. Now, we up in Harlem once again. We do a lot of Yo MTV Raps uptown. Let's get all the brothers stand right up over here. Let's get right in front of the school here because this is a law school in Mecca. And this is, I guess, like the home base, so to speak, for the brothers that are part, brothers and sisters that are part of the 5% organization, of which the Brand Nubians are part of.
Sure indeed.
So look, would you believe I had to go to the hospital where they had cable to see the video? And that's what I did, man. But I was really involved, and I appreciated the young gods and Earth keeping my name alive because I had went to prison, like, you know, the father had been persecuted for saving a young brother's life. And that meant a lot, not only to that young brother whose life I saved, but to the young brothers and sisters that knew that they had somebody that would be in the street that would sacrifice their lives for them, you know?
Yeah. You know, you mentioned, you know, obviously being away. One of the big battles that you guys fought in the 1990s into up to maybe like 2003 or so was allowing Gods and Earths literature and parliaments and stuff like that in prison. Can you talk a little bit about that battle?
Yes. Well, for me, I went to prison in 71, so it was a constant battle from that time because we always had parliaments at 2 o'clock on the last Sunday each month. So no matter where we were, we was going to have a parliament. Rather, it was sanctioned by the authorities of which we was under or not, we was going to have parliaments. And we did, and we suffered the consequence of being locked up within the prison. We'd be locked up within the prison, so to speak.
The bottom of the bottom.
The bottom of the bottom. But we, you know, suffered that persecution to advance our teachings. And during that time, we made petitions to the court to exercise not freedom of religion, but the freedom of expression under the United States Constitution. But at that time, there was no sanction to recognize philosophy, as they said, we had a philosophy different from that that's practiced by those who practice religion.
Yeah.
Okay, but later they came up with, I think of American philosopher James Williams, who, you know, said that people worship God according to the dictates of their consciousness, and it couldn't be determined by the government or the government's interest. That is up to the people to practice that as long as it wasn't no threat to their security, and that they had to find a way to allow us to exercise our freedom of our expression and worship God according to the dictates of our consciousness as opposed to the abridgment of the governmental interest.
Sure. I mean, that made it somewhat tricky in the courts, the idea that you say, you know, you both have protection as a religion and you say that it's not a religion.
Right.
It's understandable, but it was tough for the judges to understand.
Well, it wasn't really for the judges because the language was enshrined in the freedom of religion because at that time the religions was being suppressed by the British government in America, right? But the Constitution evolved to serve the interests of the people. And if the interests of the people came to the point where it wasn't a religious matter of their freedom of expression, then that expression, if it was done by a culture way, as the Indians in America didn't express themselves religiously, they expressed themselves culturally. So the president was already established for a cultural expression. But they was denying it to us because they said the only way that we could exercise it was through the religious clause.
Yeah.
And that was BS because it was already exercised by a sovereign nation in America, the Indians. And that was our example, that you recognize culture, recognize us without that persecution.
Alabi is getting into some relatively thorny legal and philosophical issues here. The gods and earths do not consider themselves to be a religion. To them, religion, broken down as rely on a jinn, requires a belief in an unseen god, which they explicitly disavow. However, because of the way various legal maneuvers worked out, the group's practices were declared legal in New York's prison system in 2003, as members were declared practitioners of a religion under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act.
So one of the things that comes up in sort of the wider press whenever the nation comes up, this happened a few years ago when Jay-Z was wearing the Universal Flag pendant.
Arm, leg, arm, head, this is God, body, knowledge, wisdom, freedom, understanding, we just want equality, food, clothing.
In the summer of 2013 and again in the spring of 2014, Jay-Z was photographed wearing a Universal Flag chain. Both times, the event got press coverage ranging from puzzled to outraged, culminating in the April 2014 New York Post story headlined, Jay-Z's Bling from Whites Are Devils Group.
There was a brief sort of uptick in news coverage. Is this idea of Yaqub and the way that's sort of distorted a lot of the media is like something about a devil or white people are devils or something. And from your point of view, can you talk a little bit about Yaqub and, you know, maybe how that's often misinterpreted and his story, his story?
Of course. Well, it's misinterpreted off the top because even when we speak about Yaqub, we speak about Yaqub, who was a renewed black man born 20 miles outside of the holy city of Mecca in the year 8400, as we say. And he was a black man. So we say that he was the father of the devil. So the premise right there is that that devil that we're talking about was first that black man, okay? And that black man made a lighter devil, a Caucasian devil, from black people, okay? So it's not just being exclusive saying that the white man is the devil. That was to give us a focus at that particular time, that the devilishment that was perpetrated against the black nation, not only in America, but in Africa and Asia and every other place, was by a foreign white devil. Okay, and we were speaking about the origin of this first manifestation, and that first manifestation came from that black devil, Yaqub. Okay, and it just so happened by that genetic engineering that was manifested by him in that time, it come to that point that we say that the one that we identified at that particular time from our hell and persecution that we suffered was from a white devil, and not as our brothers and sisters originally suffered was from a black devil. And now we see that the devil is not manifested in a person's skin, but in the contents of their very actions.
Is the Yaqub story, is that something that people in the nation will take as a metaphor or literally, or it varies?
It varies. I would say it varies. It all depends on a person's mental state, right? When a person is savage, uncivilized, they are very delusional in that they're eating the wrong foods, so they think in the wrong way. All right, and for shock value, you shock them out of that ignorance in that here's something that'll wake that ass up, something that you never heard of or something that you don't think. The Santa Claus myth don't wake people up, it puts them to sleep. But they later learned that Santa Claus was just a myth. Children waiting for that they was told, especially ghetto youth coming down the chimney, that they didn't even have a chimney in their building. All right, but they was believing that somebody gonna bring them some gifts in a red suit down the chimney that they didn't have. So, you know, we had to break them up out of that. And then the main thing is that we had to break them up out of the story that somebody came back from the grave to save them, when they could never find in history of mankind anybody ever getting up out of the grave and coming back talking to them about anything. So we had to use something, I guess, with some real shock value. And then scientifically, you know, you can go into the genes genetically and see that the makeup of genes, there's some dominant genes and there's some recessively weak genes. And it plays out in, you know, the ectodermia of our very complexion, the melanin of our very skin. So it was a little of all of that, but the advance the teachings, you had to study. And that's what we say, everybody got to do their research, you know, and the research, the reward of research is knowledge and discovery and finding out what is and what ain't.
So finally, we're sitting outside the Allah School in Mecca. What is going on with the school now? I know you have after school programs. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, well, we have after school programs that is open from 2:30 to actually 9 o'clock in the evening, p.m. And they range from 4-year-olds to 24-year-olds that could have instructions in after school remedial courses or whatever the case they may be doing at school. A GED program under the new TAS system, the 120 class that we teach our lessons of 120 degrees, the history class of biology. We also have community programs, a community service program with the New York City court system, where people that have minor offense can satisfy their disposition here and have it dismissed later after completing, you know, that community service at the law school in Mecca. We have an NA program for those brothers and sisters that suffer drug abuse and substance abuse and things of that nature. Of course, the sister have a head wrap in class, Queen Watisha. You know, Umala has an executive training course. Sunez has a political action education enrichment course. You know, we have a gamut of courses and teachings and instructions here at the law school in Mecca. And the computer lab, which is the last area of repair that right. We finalizing the full upgrade of a computer lab with new everything, new walls, ceilings, lights, computers, desks, and everything. So it's going to be the crown jewel of a law school in Mecca. And it been times, I instruct the computer class, and it been times that we service in the course of a day 80 youths from the neighborhoods. And the one thing I like about it, that they have warring factions from the different housing projects, the St. Nicholas projects, Manhattanville, the Grand projects, and the Johnson and the Lincoln project. But all of those youths from the different projects at different times come to the school, and they be in peace. As they come through the door, they be in peace. As they're in the computer lab at the school, they're in peace. And when they leave, they be in peace. And that's real, real special, because they be in murder situations in other places. You know, it's sad, but we would love to spread that peaceful environment that they get at, you know, a law school in Mecca in their projects where they live.
And I have to ask you, because this show is called The Cypher, in no small part because of its associations with you, can you build on the idea of cypher for us for a minute?
Yeah, I love the cypher because in our cypher, we all come together to build, okay? And that's the basic premise of forming the cypher. And when we say when we come together, we see Allah. So when we come together, we see Allah in all of our very being. And a cypher is see our power, her. And her, in this instance, is the impregnation by the Father of bright, brilliant ideas. So we build to impregnate each other with them bright, brilliant ideas and fat her. And when you fat her, things grow. And the analogy of it is that if you impregnate a woman and you fat her, you're going to fat her with a child. And we say the children is the greatest. So the babies is the greatest. So when we impregnate, you know, them ideas in the atmosphere, we impregnate, hopefully, people with the greatest ideas to be the best that they could be. And that's the greatest, you know, because all us are children of God, are either children of the Most High, and the Most High is Allah. As nobody could deny that Allah is spelt out in the acronym of their body parts, the arm, leg, leg, arm, head. A-L-L-A-H, Allah. That's the creator. That's the architecture. That's the author of our very being. And that's a book that was written by Allah. And now we got to live it out in the cipher of the universe. 360 degrees of life, love, peace, and happiness. And that's what it's all about. So that cipher is a bridge of transformation to get from one point to another. And you add from the cipher of knowledge, from knowledge to born, and you add that cipher. From the cipher of wisdom to born, and you add that cipher. And from the cipher of understanding to born, and you add that cipher. And so on and so on and so on. And it's infinite, it's continuous. As though we just say 360 degrees is a complete cipher. But where it begins, you can't determine its origin or its beginning point. Where it ends, you can't determine this determinating ending point. It goes on and on. What did Erykah Badu say? On and on and on and on. What she say? What's that? Three nickels? She say three something and a dime, or six dimes, or six pennies. I forget what it is, but she build up 360.
And six dimes. Yeah, you may laugh, 'cause you did not do your math.
And she mentioned the knowledge, wisdom, understanding, and on, you know. So that's peace. That's a cipher, and that's a good cipher. And I'm glad that you invited me to the cipher. And I want to thank your program, the production company, and you for being the gracious host. And I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, all of you. Really appreciate it.
Peace.
I've long been interested in the gods and earths. I've found the more you learn about them, the more you learn about hip-hop. The two are so intertwined as to basically be inseparable. It was something really special to get an idea of exactly how that happened in this interview. The history of the Five Percenters, and how it ties into the larger picture of New York City politics and the FBI's efforts to suppress dissent, is fascinating. I hope that you get some idea of this here, and we've included a few relevant links at thecyphershow.com if you're interested in learning more. Join us next week when our guest will be Elzai. The Detroit rapper came to most people's attention as a member of the legendary group Slum Village. A few years ago, he went solo and released an ambitious project, reinventing Nas's classic debut album as Almatic. His fantastic new album is called Lead Poison. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out by becoming a patron. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Because it wasn't my suit of clothes to be in a youth, put on a bow tie and things of that nature.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And I used to do that every week.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Arm, leg, leg, arm, head. And that was his name.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
They were the firstborn of Pelon.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
Like they used to say, the oligarchs, you know, the OGs.
Special thanks to our top Patreon supporter, Vikram.
F him.
And an extra special thanks to Allah B and everyone at the Allah School in Mecca.
We was already rapping.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Came through and I ignored it.